Good morning. Imagine for a moment that you all are a new group of believers struggling to hold on to your faith. You're discouraged. You're weary. You're tired of standing out because of Christ. Why? Because you've seen what happens to others who do the same. They've been publicly ridiculed. They've been thrown in jail. Some of them have even given their very lives for Christ. You want to follow Him. You want to hold on to this new faith that you have, and yet you're not sure if you can keep going. What if I were appointed by God to encourage you not to give up? What do you think I would tell you? Let's say I get one promise to encourage you with. One great and precious promise that's supposed to help push you to keep the faith. What do you think that would be? Well, what I've just described is exactly the situation that we're going to see in our text for this morning. We're in the book of Hebrews, if you want to start turning there, which was written to just such this group of weary believers. And what you see several times throughout the book is this author pushing the people to keep the faith. And in chapter 12, we find one last effort from him to convince his readers that they must not, they cannot give up their faith. He begins with a challenge and then reminds them of a promise that would help sustain them in the midst of their difficulties. We're going to start first with the challenge. And that begins in Hebrews chapter 12 and in verse 3. Hebrews 12 and verse 3. Consider him, that is Jesus, who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. So the imagery that we have here in verse 4 is athletic. It's that of a boxing match where you have fighters trading blow for blow. But the opponent here, it's not another person per se, it's sin. Now, this is not just an inward struggle with personal sin. It's a lot of times how we want to think about sin. That's part of it. But it's much bigger than that. It's probably more so an outward struggle with the effects of sin. And it's seen most notably in the people who are opposing these new believers. We saw in verse 3, as Jesus dealt with sinners and their hostility, so too were these believers facing opposition to their faith. And they were in danger of giving up their faith because of it. Now, on the one hand, that's certainly understandable, right? Because we read elsewhere in Hebrews how their fellow Christians had been ridiculed for their faith, how their property had been taken away from their faith, how they'd been thrown in jail for their faith, and how others of their brothers and sisters had given up their lives for their faith. So you can see why some of these people had begun to wonder whether they could keep going, whether it might be time to throw in the towel and just give up this Christianity thing. And so the author challenges them that as Jesus persevered in the face of opposition, so must they endure. There's also a gentle rebuke in there. What they were going through, that was certainly difficult. He's not demeaning what they are going through. But at the same time, it did not compare with what Jesus went through. These people had not yet given their lives for their faith. If Jesus could endure all the way to the cross in the face of such unimaginable opposition, they too could hold on. So that's his challenge. Hold on. Do not lose heart. Do not grow weary. And yet he knows that probably something more is needed for them. Something even more encouraging that's going to push them through the finish line of their faith. And he has one last chance in this book to convince them that what they are going through is worth it. And that's where we come to the promise. Now think about this. Out of hundreds and hundreds of promises that the author could draw upon from the Old Testament to remind these believers, don't give up. Keep the faith. Out of the hundreds of promises, we can think of several that he might choose that we think right away, oh, that's what would be so encouraging to these people. But what does he choose? The one thing he thinks will help keep them in the race for their faith. It's not what we would expect. Look at verses 5 and 6. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? So already we see they should know this. And in fact, this is a well-known promise from the Old Testament that they should have been aware of, that should have been on their minds. Have you forgotten? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. Why? For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. Okay, wait a second. That's the great encouragement? He's got one shot at this. And he chooses to encourage them by reminding them that their hardship is discipline? How's that supposed to help them? And what in the world do we do with this? Well, answering that, friends, is our task for this morning. Because those first century Christians, they weren't the only ones who were promised the discipline of God. And they're also not the only ones who struggle at times to keep the faith. And so this promise has every bit as much to do with us today as it did to these weary believers 2,000 years ago. And it's my prayer that as we explore this great and precious promise together, we too will be encouraged to keep the faith and remain steadfast in our commitment to Christ. The author has thrown this promise out here, but now he's got some explaining to do. Because I would imagine that they, not unlike us, are probably sitting there thinking, okay, I hear you, but how is this supposed to encourage us? This seems, if anything, that it would be discouraging, that it would be depressing, that on top of the trouble, we find out this is actually discipline from God. How is this helping us encourage us to go and hold on to the faith? And so that's what the author is going to spend the next part of this passage doing, explaining just why this should encourage the believers. Three things we're going to see about God's discipline in the following verses. First, the encouragement of God's discipline. Why is it something that's good for them? How does it push them to keep going? Second, the proper response to God's discipline. Once we know of it, what do we do with it? And third, the benefits of God's discipline. What's it all for? And what's the point? So look with me first at the beginning of verse 7, where we're going to start to see the encouragement of God's discipline. Look at the beginning of verse 7. It is for discipline that you have to endure. In other words, for these believers, all the persecution, all the hardship that they were experiencing because of their faith, it was purposeful. That was all a part of God's discipline in their lives. Now, we hear that word discipline, and what do we think right away? We think of punishment, right? It's a bad thing. And because of that, it's really hard for us to get a clear picture of what's going on here. Punishment is certainly a part of that. But especially in this letter's first century context, the concept of discipline meant so much more than just somebody getting in trouble. Think of it as the sum total of one's experience that helps train them up, that helps guide them in the way that they should go. Now, part of that may involve punishment when it's deserved. That's true. But more so, it's really any difficult circumstance that better train someone for what they need to know or what they need to be able to do. Since we saw that athletic imagery earlier in verse 4, Let's think about all the Olympic athletes that we've seen competing over the last few weeks. All their training was designed for one purpose. They want to prepare their bodies to be able to compete against the highest level of competition in the world. But more than that, they want to win. So what they ate, how they practiced, what they did in their free time, all of it was a part of disciplining their bodies, training them for the competition that was ahead. And that's no easy process, because once they've reached one goal, do they just stop and say, okay, great, I reached that milestone I had? No, now it's time to reach another one, and then another one, and another one. And it's all blood, sweat, and tears to discipline up their body to get them where they want to be. So then it was time for them to compete. They were ready. They've disciplined their bodies for the tasks ahead, and that training, that's what's going to keep them going when it gets tough. That's what's going to allow them to finish the race. And that even though they may be down to their last gasps of oxygen, their legs will not give out until they cross the finish line. It's what all that discipline, it's what all that training was for. And that's the process of God's discipline in the lives of his people. It's placing difficult circumstances in our paths to train us up in a certain way. Now, what that way is, we don't yet know. That's coming later in the passage. But for now, the author is keen to point out that all of this hardship that his readers were experiencing, it was purposeful. It was all a part of God's training plan for them. And why should that fact encourage these weary believers? Let's keep reading in verses 7 and 8. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. This is remarkable. The fact that believers experience God's discipline, his instructive training, far from being a discouraging thing, it ought to be a most reassuring thing. Why? Because the fact that it's happening confirms that we really are his children. And on the flip side, if we're not experiencing it in our lives, it may well be that we're not his children. Kids, teens, you can relate to this, right? Okay, I know this is going to be hard for you to imagine, but think with me here, that you are with a group of your friends and you're doing something that you are not supposed to be doing. Your mom gets wind of this and comes to confront you about it. So you're with your group of friends and she comes riding up in the car, opens the door, comes storming out, and she is going to give a lecture to you and all of your friends about what you're doing, right? No. She looks squarely at you, and you get all of her earful for what you are doing. And you think, that's so unfair. They're all doing this too. Why are you just yelling at me? Why aren't you yelling at them? To which she replies, they're not my kid, but you are. She wants to make sure she is doing what she can to discipline you, to guide you, to train you up in the way she knows you should go, because she's hoping that at the end of that, you just might turn out to be a responsible adult. That's the goal. Those other kids, they're not really her problem, because they're not hers. She's focused on you and helping to train you up to be who you can be. And it might seem like a pain when you're getting all of this attention and you see these others who don't seem to be getting in much trouble, or maybe their parents don't really care what they're doing. But trust me, be thankful. You might not realize it now, but you'll look back someday and be very, very grateful that you had someone in your life who cared enough for you to take an interest and to guide you into who you can be. And it's the same thing with our Heavenly Father, who lovingly disciplines those who are his children. And it can be difficult. And yet it ought to be a great comfort to us who are experiencing it, because it means that we really are his children. And those who aren't experiencing his discipline, unfortunately, have reason to question whether they truly are his children. Now, we certainly don't have it nearly as badly as these people did here in the first century, but it doesn't mean that this doesn't apply to us. I mean, I think it's certainly fair to look at our lives and see whether there is evidence of this type of discipline, of this type of instructive guidance of God in our lives. Because if we're skating scot-free through life and our faith doesn't really seem to have any kind of noticeable effect on our circumstances, we might do well to consider what that could mean. Because as God's children, we can expect that his loving discipline will train us up in the way that we ought to go if we are indeed his children. Now, maybe that does mean that there's some measure of opposition to our faith. We experience that on a little bit of scale here in this country, certainly not what others do. But even so, there are other circumstances that come into our lives that challenge us, right? And I know this passage is specifically talking about hardship due to opposition to faith, but I think it's valid to look at it and say that it could be that God puts perhaps other difficulties into our lives to have a same disciplinary effect as well. It's not that God is necessarily punishing us for something that we've done, but that he's using hard situations as part of his training process in our lives. This reminds me of a co-worker of mine and his wife who lost everything, well, almost everything that they owned in a fire to their apartment. And in the midst of that difficulty, it was really remarkable to see what that dear couple learned through that experience. And to hear them share the testimony of how they were encouraged by others who came alongside them to help them, how they were encouraged by how the Lord provided for them, and how they were reminded of what is truly important in this life, and to be grateful for what they do have. God used that tragic circumstance to help them grow. And it wasn't only they who learned, it was the rest of us as well who heard their testimony. We received that discipline too, that guidance as we heard them share. Noelle and I were especially challenged because we realized after hearing it how prone we are to hold on to the stuff of this life. And it was a really good reminder for us to be grateful, yes, for what God has given us, but to remember that this is not ultimately our home. And so we give thanks for what we have, but we hold on to it loosely, knowing that at any moment it may be gone. And that's okay. It's a part of discipline. It's a part of training us up in the way that we ought to think, in the way that we ought to act. Think about your lives in particular. All of us have had experience of firsthand learning through the discipline of God. It's one thing to read in God's word, for example, to trust God. We read that and we think, okay, I need to learn how to trust God. I need to learn how to trust God. That's one thing. But it's quite another to learn firsthand, isn't it? That when that bank account is getting low and you're not sure where the bills are going to come from, and you know the only one who's going to provide it is our good and gracious God, that is discipline. It's training us up to think and act as the Lord would want us to. It's one thing to read in Scripture about how God is our comfort. It's another thing to learn firsthand how true that really is when we're in the throes of terrible pain and sorrow, and we do see that, yes, indeed, God is our comfort, because he was with us every step of the way. It's discipline. It's not punishment. It's instructive training to get us to think and to act as God would want us to. How comforting to know that we have a God who cares enough to train us in the way that he would want us to go. Now, yes, are sometimes the difficult things that come into our lives the result of our sin? It really is punishment because of our sin? Yes, it is. And in those instances, we would do well to take heed to what God is trying to do. And perhaps there's been an unconfessed sin in our life for far too long, and God's trying to get our attention. That could well be part of his discipline in our lives. All of it goes together. Maybe there's been something that you've been hiding for years and years, and it doesn't really seem, though, that you're actually experiencing that kind of discipline in your life. I think at that point, you would do well to look inside and reflect, because how terrible it would be to not be receiving discipline and training from the Lord because you find that you are not really his. Why should God's people be encouraged by his loving discipline? Because his discipline, his training assures us that we are truly his children. Okay, so now we know that. But so what? Again, put yourself in the shoes of these folks here. They're hearing this and they say, okay, I think I'm seeing how this is encouraging. But there seems like there's got to be more to this picture here. What do we do with this? So what? That's in verse 9, where we see the proper response to God's discipline. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? It's an argument from the lesser to the greater. The author of Hebrews does this all the time because he wants to make a punchy point. In general, we respect our earthly disciplinarians, imperfect as they may be. We might not like it, but in general, we know we need to obey, and so we submit to the discipline of those that are over us here. But if that's true, how much more then should we submit to the discipline of God? In other words, we take what he's trying to teach us, we accept it, We don't just hear it, we do something with it. We don't run from it, we don't ignore it, we actually submit ourselves to this training that he has for us. I mean, it would be a lot easier if it were just automatic, right? I mean, we see the discipline and poof, we're changed, we grow. That would be great. But that's not how it works. Because recognizing when God is trying to discipline us, when he's trying to train us, recognizing it is only half of the process. We also have to submit to it and do what it is that God is asking us to do. Let's go back to our athlete who's training for the Olympics. Let's say he wants to do the 100-meter dash, perhaps the ultimate test of speed and strength. He wants to train for this. So his coach comes up with this wonderful regimen for him. It's this perfect dose of weightlifting and of running training and of diet. It's the perfect blend that's going to get him exactly where he wants to go. Now, it's one thing for that coach to propose that to the athlete. The athlete might even receive it and say, yes, I understand that this could help me run the fastest time in the world. But then what does the athlete have to actually do? He's got to put it into practice, because he well could take that advice and say, you know what? I'd rather binge watch Netflix and eat ice cream. That's my training plan. Well, that's fine, but that's not going to get him the gold medal in the 100 meter dash. He has a plan that he knows will work, but he actually has to submit to it. And so it is with God's discipline in our lives. Because it is entirely possible to recognize what he is trying to do and yet decide we don't really want to learn that way. We'd rather keep doing what we're doing. We're perfectly content in the way that we're going. I'm sure these believers in the first century, I'm sure they could have thought of a whole lot of other ways that they would have rather been encouraged by God, that they would have rather been trained up and disciplined by God than this harsh opposition to their faith. But it wasn't their job to tell God how to do his work. And it's not ours either. And so when we feel the Spirit pricking at our heart about an attitude that we need to change, or about an action that we need to improve, or a sin that needs to be confessed, and then he brings up an opportunity for us to do something about it, do we take advantage of it? Do we allow that to refocus our attitude, to draw us to repentance? Or do we ignore the Spirit and just keep right on going as we were? God's discipline should encourage us, because it assures us that we are his children, and in response, we are to submit to his discipline. But there's still one big unanswered question at this point. What's the point of all this? I mean, really, what's it for? If this is supposed to encourage these first century believers who are weary, who are struggling, who want to give up the fight for their faith, if that's what this is supposed to do, I think it probably would be good for them to know what this discipline is actually supposed to do for them, wouldn't it? And that's where the author saves his best for last, as we conclude in verses 10 and 11, where we're going to see the benefits of God's discipline for his children. Look beginning in verse 10, at the very beginning. For they, that is earthly parents, disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them. But he disciplines us for our good. God's discipline is for our good. Don't miss that. Our earthly disciplinarians, they've done the best that they can, but they're not perfect. Sometimes the discipline they had for us, it wasn't what was best for us. But not so with our Heavenly Father. I'll never forget, about a year ago, Zoe was being a stinker all day long. And it was starting to drain on me. And she was pestering her brother, and that was making him upset. And so this was a perfect storm of things to test this father's patience. And so we're sitting there at the dinner table, and I've warned Zoe over and over, stop pestering your brother, stop pestering your brother. And I'm looking down eating, and I look back up, and I see her over there fiddling. And it just came out. Zoe May. And you see her face just wilt. And the little lip starts quivering, and the tears start flowing. It was a mess. And I come to find out that she wasn't actually pestering her brother. She was actually trying to help him with something. And I had harshly disciplined her for something that she did not deserve. I can file that one away in the dad fail category. I learned my lesson. We've all had that experience, haven't we? Either we've been the one to give out punishment that wasn't deserved, or we've been the one to receive discipline that's not deserved. That's what you get when you deal with imperfect people. It's not always going to be right. Sometimes discipline is given out for the wrong motives. Sometimes it's given out without all the right information. Sometimes it's given out in anger. But not so with God. It is never in anger. It is never undeserved. It is never for his selfish reasons. It is always right, and it is always for our good. Now just think about that for a second. Because I fear that many of us have long had this view of God as some kind of potentate up there in the sky who's looking down on us, just waiting for us to screw up so that he can zap us and he can make our lives miserable. And so we go through the Christian life utterly discouraged, because as much as we try to live for him, as much as we try to grow, We know that we can't measure up, and so around every turn, we're just waiting for God's punishment to hit us. Because we think that's the kind of discipline that he bestows on us. It is true that God will at times discipline us when we have gone astray. But when he does it, it is for a purpose and it is for our good. Because he wants to make us holy. And so we submit to his loving discipline because we want to grow, to become more like him. And that's the second benefit as we wrap up in verse 11. Actually, at the end of verses 10 and 11, the second benefit of God's discipline. Look there at the end of 10. But he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. The Lord's discipline will rarely be pleasant, but it will always be purposeful. He is growing us. He is stretching us. He is conforming us to be more like children who resemble their Holy Father. And when we're in the throes of it, we don't have to wonder what the point of it is. We know he's training us up in righteousness. He's preparing us for that future day when we will truly be like him. And that is why these first century believers needed to keep the faith, why they needed to stay in the fight. And that is why we need to stay in the race for our faith. Because it is only through this process of loving yet painful discipline that we will one day see our Father and we will be like him. And oh, will it be worth it? What we have gone through in our time on this earth as part of God's painful yet loving training will all be worth it. To know that we have finished the race, that we have kept the faith, and that we can then enjoy the presence of our Father forever. God's discipline should encourage us because it assures us that we are his children. And in response, we are to submit to God's discipline in our lives. Why? Because it is for our good and for the goal of making us more like him. And as we seek to take the first steps toward orienting our minds toward that this morning, I think we would do well to take the advice of the author in verse 3. To consider him. To consider Jesus. The one who endured so much at the hands of sinners and yet did not give up. Demonstrating to all of us who now seek to follow him as our model that it can be done. That God's loving discipline, though painful, can be endured and it can bring about the result that God has intended it to have. And so this morning as we take communion, I would encourage us all to think about the ways in which God may be using this process in our lives specifically. It may be that his discipline looks like some form of punishment for sin that's in our lives. And we know it. We know what we need to do with it. We know that we need to confess it. And we know that we need to turn from it. And we need to walk in righteousness. We know that, but we're not yet willing to do it. This may be a good time for a heart-to-heart with the Spirit, as we seek to grow and heed what he would have for us to do. Some of you may be weary this morning because you recognize that things in your life would be a whole lot easier if you didn't have this faith thing. That things would be a whole lot less arduous, would take a whole lot less of a toll on you if you weren't seeking to follow Christ faithfully in a world of opposition to Him. And to you this morning, I say, hold on. Consider Him who endured hostility from sinners so that you may not grow weary or lose heart. Let us consider Him this morning.